It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a look at science news, including why scientists are studying the gut bacteria of indigenous people in the Amazon rainforest. First, where you work, receive health care, or send your kids to school all depends on where you can afford to live. And in different areas around Wisconsin, the cost of housing is going up and people's incomes are not keeping pace. That has some experts and public officials calling for a renewed focus on affordable housing. This Wednesday and Thursday, a conference in Eau Claire called A Home for Everyone is bringing researchers and community groups together to talk about how to address the state's rising cost of housing. Kathy Camp is the executive director of the nonprofit Wisconsin Partnership for Housing Development, the group hosting the conference. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Kurt Paulson is an associate professor of planning and landscape architecture at UW-Madison. His research focuses on affordable housing policy. Kurt, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Kurt, let's talk about who affordable housing is really for. It could be easy to think it applies only to people with very low or limited incomes, but is that really the case?
No, affordable housing really is something that every family needs, whether it's single-parent households or people with disabilities, seniors, people in the workforce. We see up and down the income scale that when there's a shortage of housing, everyone finds affordability to be a challenge, and they have difficulty getting housing.
So it sounds like affordable can be very different depending on the cost of living in a particular community or, for instance, how much housing is available.
Right. So a house that is affordable in Eau Claire might not be affordable in Madison just because of the differences in house prices.
Or, for instance, I just heard something on NPR over the weekend that I think a two-bedroom apartment averages over $2,000 a month. That would certainly be a lot less affordable here, but it was even a struggle for people in that area.
Right. So an average two-bedroom apartment in Madison might be $1,700 or $1,800, depending on how new it is. But a two-bedroom unit in Green Bay might rent for $900 or $1,000. But income levels are going to be different in different parts of the state as well.
And I've also heard the term workforce housing. Is that the same as affordable housing or is it different?
So there's a lot of overlap in these terms, and people use them kind of interchangeably. We talk about workforce housing to mean the concept that people should be able to afford to live in the same community where they work based on the wages they earn. So it's a broader concept that includes not just people on the lower end of the wage scale, but even modest income or professional workers. So, for example, in my city of Middleton, a starting teacher in the school district or a starting police officer might make $55,000. Which seems like a decent wage in other parts of the state, but they really can't afford to live in our community at that price.
And Kathy, is housing affordability an issue for people around the entire state?
It is. I think that there's no place in the state that someone who makes minimum wage can afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment. So affordability is an issue across the state. As Kurt said, incomes vary, housing costs vary. But for people who make less than $16 an hour, the housing wage across the state of Wisconsin is $16.77, meaning that you have to make that much per hour to be able to afford a basic two-bedroom apartment. And there's really no place across the state where someone can do that on minimum wage or even slightly better than a minimum wage job.
And remind us what minimum wage is right now.
Minimum wage in Wisconsin is $7.25, which is extremely low. And, you know, many of the fast food restaurants, you might make minimum wage, although few people make exactly minimum wage. But even so, the housing wage tells us that on average across the state, you have to make almost $17 an hour to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment. And that varies from in Madison, that number is actually much higher. It's $21.02, which is extremely high when you think about, service workers and really a lot of the jobs that are being created now don't necessarily pay that much money. So as Kurt said, they might have a job, they might have a decent job at $18 or $19 an hour, and they can't afford to live in the community where they work.
And so just to do the math a little bit, so $7.25, so that's that's only a third of what the housing wage is, for instance, in Madison. And also, mm-hmm. when you're calculating that you need a certain wage to be able to afford an apartment, am I right that that's about 30% of your income that you're expected to spend on housing?
That's correct. They usually stay affordable. Affordable in the realm of housing is paying about 30% of your income for rent. But obviously, at higher income levels, you can pay more than that. And it's not going to impact your ability to afford food or childcare or health care. But at that very low income, those very low income levels, if they pay more than 30%, they don't have enough left for the basic mm-hmm. necessities of life.
Kurt?
And the truth is, we don't look just at the cost, because you can reduce your housing costs by living really far away from your work or tripling up in a room. And so when we talk about affordability, it's also the broader concept that families and workers should be able to afford a decent, safe, healthy house close to where they work. For a lot of workers, the only way to make housing affordable is to live really far away. That means they're stuck in traffic, or if there's snow, difficult to get to work, difficult to get to childcare.
I was going to say that might cut down on one type of cost, but it probably comes with other types of costs, including if you have to leave your kids at childcare for 2 extra hours a day.
Right.
We are talking about affordable housing, what it is and who benefits from it. It's not just the people that may be living in it. Kathy Camp is the executive director of the Wisconsin Partnership for Housing Development, and Kurt Paulson is an associate professor of planning and landscape architecture at UW-Madison. We're talking about this as we come up to a statewide conference later this week. And Kurt, let's talk about that ripple effect. So what happens if workers are not able to afford to live near where the jobs are? What happens for the employers?
So I've heard from employers around the state that they have difficulty recruiting and retaining workers, especially if you're we've talked to employers who run shift work, good manufacturing jobs or cleaning jobs, even paying $16, $17, $18 an hour. It's hard to get a worker if they're living 45 minutes away. A closer employer might offer them the same wage, then they don't have to commute. Or certainly here in Madison, traffic, snow, getting your kids to school on time, it really becomes an economic development challenge for our employers. I heard from an economic development director in a county a couple weeks ago, and he said they have 600 jobs that are sitting open right now today, but they can't get anyone to move there because there's just a lack of available housing anywhere near where those jobs are located.
And who else benefits when workers are able to live close to where they're employed?
So it fosters community participation, solidarity. When you're working in an area and your kids go to school with the other people who work there, helps to build community. It also reduces traffic.
And so, and also that could have environmental impacts, for
exactly.
instance.
When workers have to drive long distances just to be able to afford it, obviously that costs them a lot of money in terms of gas, but that just causes a lot of environmental pollution.
And Kathy, a big focus of the conference happening in Eau Claire this week is the impact of housing on health care. What's the relationship there?
Well, there's actually been shown to be a very strong relationship between stability in someone's housing and health, particularly for children, but also for mental health related to the adults in the household. So frequent moves causes mental health stress for the adults where their children are moving. They're having to move their children frequently, and it creates issues in schools as well because those kids are changing schools maybe every year. And so it impacts housing also in the sense that our housing stock in our state is particularly old, and some of that housing has lead paint, it has asbestos, it has things that aren't safe for kids to be around. And as people become unable to afford their housing, they move into less and less suitable housing. And sometimes that creates big issues related to health for children.
I have to say, it seems like in many parts of the state, there's a lot of construction going on. There are a lot of new buildings. You would think that at some point these housing costs would at least stabilize, even if they're not going down, because there's just more available. But it doesn't necessarily seem like it works that way, Kurt.
Right. Well, I have a report coming out soon that looks at these trends. And even though we're building a lot of housing units, The truth is, compared to what we used to produce, our housing production has been cut in half. And so even though, especially in Madison, you see all the cranes up, you see all the construction going up, we are building a lot of units, and that's helped prices to moderate or go up more slowly. But the truth is, we're really falling behind because we're adding more people than we're adding housing units. So there's continues to be this shortage, this underproduction of housing. And we see that not just in the big cities or fast-growing counties like Dane County or Waukesha County, but we see it in small towns and in the rural areas. So even though it looks like we're building a lot, and that's helped us not have the same problems you would see in San Francisco or New York, right? We're not building enough.
We are talking with Kathy Camp and Kurt Paulson right now about what affordable housing means and how the issue is affecting Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen housing costs take up a larger portion of your monthly budget than it used to? Have you had trouble affording a place to live where you work? And do you feel priced out of certain cities or neighborhoods? What changes do you think could be made to make housing more affordable and accessible in your area? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about housing affordability with Kathy Camp, director of the Wisconsin Partnership for Housing Development, and Kurt Paulson from UW-Madison. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you felt the impact of rising housing costs in your area? Have you had trouble finding a place to live close to where you work? Are housing costs a big financial burden for you? And what kind of housing do you think your area needs more of? What do you think about the housing issue needs more attention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have Patrick in Richland County on the line. Hi, Patrick.
Yes, good afternoon. Great show. You guys are doing a good job.
Thank you.
Which county has 600 open jobs?
That's Barron County, north of Eau Claire.
Right. So what am I missing here? If these are such great jobs, then people would move there and get these great paying jobs, and they'd be good enough paying that you could build your house or somebody would be building spec homes. What am I missing? Maybe they're just not paying quite enough?
Great. Thanks for that call, Patrick.
So that's a great question, and I don't know the particulars of that situation, but in many of our small towns, and it's not just Barron County, I've heard from other economic development directors, it's hard to get developers to come into a community and build housing or to build new housing, and there's kind of a shortage. And so oftentimes to bring in that many people into a new area, you would need to build new housing. And the truth is that the construction costs in Barron County are going to be about the same as they are in Dane County, and so it's going to be very hard, even if someone's making a decent wage of about $50,000, for a new house to be built for anything less than like $250,000, and that may not be really affordable for these high-quality jobs. So there's really a mismatch between oftentimes construction costs and the incomes that people earn. So when we talk about housing affordability, it's the ratio of your housing costs to income. So we can either increase people's income or reduce housing costs. And that's where I think small towns, rural counties, and Barron County is a leader, is getting innovative in enticing developers to come in, maybe helping them with land assembly, maybe some tax credits for infrastructure development. And cities are looking at what they can do to reduce their zoning costs or regulations that drive up the cost of housing and make it hard for people to move or build new housing.
Thanks for that call, Patrick. And Kurt, actually, that was something just before the break. I was thinking about what are some of the creative, in the best possible way, creative ways that municipalities or coalitions can work to help make affordable, available housing a reality.
Right. So we often say that we're never going to solve our housing crisis without more housing supply. We need more of every type of housing everywhere. But just more housing alone won't solve our crisis because, as Kathy talked about, we have a older housing stock and a lot of people will live in already built housing. But the most significant way for municipalities is to look at their zoning regulations and their subdivision regulations and look at to what extent they're driving up the cost of housing by requiring large lot sizes, excessive parking requirements, requiring higher levels of finishing. In many communities, it's really hard to build duplexes, quadplexes, maybe small rental housing because the zoning codes do not allow it. So one thing municipalities can do is look at their zoning and see, are we providing a range of these different styles and types and sizes of housing that meets different price points?
And actually, Kathy, that was something I was thinking about as well. The range, it seems like if there are, you know, say closer to the center, the older housing stock, like you said, that has a lot of problems, that might be cheaper, but it comes with other costs. But then, you know, as you go out, you have the more expensive, then you have the much cheaper. It almost seems like a type of segregation depending on income and job class.
Well, one of the sessions at the conference is going to cover really that kind of segregation and the prejudice that we are experiencing because of housing types. And it's changed over time in certain communities. The inner city used to be the place where cheap housing was, where the suburbs were on the outsides of communities, and white flight moved people out into the suburb areas. Now that's kind of switching. People with more income want to live closer to the central city. They have they're closer to their jobs. They can afford to live in that area.
There might be more entertainment, restaurants, things like that.
More for them to do, that's for sure. And so we're sort of seeing, you know, a switch in terms of how we segregate, but the fact that we're segregating based on housing and housing type is real.
And Kathy, have you seen projects that have successfully planned in advance so that the developer or whoever is in charge of the new construction commits to providing a range of housing maybe within one complex?
Yes, I think that there's a number of models where that happens, and we've seen it happen in good ways across the state. I think that a lot of it comes back to what Kurt was talking about in terms of cities requiring certain things. I think a lot of times when that works well, it's because the city is applying rules even-handedly across all developers and requiring that some affordable housing be included in every development that is produced.
We're talking about affordable housing in Wisconsin with Kathy Camp from the Wisconsin Partnership for Housing Development and Kurt Paulson, Associate Professor of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. And what are some of those incentives, Kurt, that can induce developers to not just create affordable housing, but kind of mixed housing?
So there's a number of ways you can do it. In a lot of the cities, what we have seen works is when a municipality will prepare an area, maybe near jobs, near transit, and they will say, like we did in our city of Middleton, this is where we want affordable housing and we want mixed income housing. And then we help the developers to get access to federal and state housing tax credits that help to reduce the cost and make units affordable. But there in our development process, we're really looking for a mixture of incomes, and we want both market rate and affordable units in the same development. But municipalities can use a number of financial incentives. They can use TIF.
Which is tax
increment financing, right? They can help developers submit applications to the state and the federal government for various federal programs, state housing tax credits, federal housing tax credits. There's really a wide range of financial tools. They can provide down payment assistance programs. They can provide grants and loans to nonprofits like Kathy's group that do great in terms of housing rehab and affordable products.
And so it sounds like if there's a will, there may be some ways to get there.
There's a number of tools that a municipality can use. Of course, like anything, a lot of it does boil down to financial resources. And the truth is that, you know, there's a lot of good nonprofits around the state that build a lot of really good, high-quality, affordable housing, rehab existing housing, but it's at a small enough scale, and with more financial resources, they can do more work. And I think you see states around the country are really thinking about stepping up in terms of providing more resources, because we don't anticipate the federal government really fulfilling its commitment to affordable housing and integrated communities.
And Kathy, what is the kind of what's the threshold for qualifying for maybe some kind of assistance in housing? It seems like there, as often is the case, there are people who are really in desperate need of help, and there's quite likely help there. And there are people that are doing fine when we said even spending more than the recommended 30%. What about that probably working middle, working poor? It seems like they're probably having maybe the hardest time.
They do have a hard time. And I think that, federal resources are typically available to people who make less than 80% of the area median income or 60% of the area median income in tax credit projects. So we're looking at people who are not quite at that median. And I think that they're the ones who struggle in terms of finding housing. For one thing, a lot of people in the past used to make their housing affordable by Section 8 voucher, using a Section 8 voucher, what's now called a Family Choice voucher. And only about a quarter of people who are eligible for that program can actually get a voucher. So those people who don't get a voucher are paying way more than they should be for housing, and they're really being left out in the cold in terms of affordability.
And there's probably no guarantee that the Section 8 housing is available where they need to or want to live either.
That's exactly right. And they don't have access necessarily to, the neighborhood where their children go to school or where they want to live. And so it's very difficult in that way.
And Kurt, as we wrap up, are you seeing any signs that housing costs are getting more attention from lawmakers, understanding what it means for many of their constituents who might be trying to find employees?
Yes, I think housing is on everyone's radar, and housing affordability is really becoming this bipartisan issue. And we hope that through this continued advocacy that people in the state legislature, as they hear from their constituents, will really start. And I see a lot of leadership from both the Assembly, the Senate, and the governor's office to look at this and to think about it as a systemic issue, to make housing a priority, and to work with local governments to expand housing choices, expand options.
Well, Kurt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kathy, thanks so much for coming in.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
Kurt Paulson is a professor of planning and landscape architecture at UW-Madison. Kathy Camp is the executive director of the Wisconsin Partnership for Housing Development. We were talking about housing costs in the state ahead of an affordable housing conference being held this week in Eau Claire. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at new scientific research, including whether a robot can pick veggies as efficiently as a human being. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, a new Trump administration rule would make it harder for most Central American migrants to seek asylum in the U.S. We'll look at how the new policy is designed to work and the likely legal challenge to follow. First, it's time for our monthly check-in on the latest news from the world of science. Researchers are racing to analyze and preserve the gut flora of people who have not eaten a processed Western diet. Plus, there's a reason that we say something goes viral when it spreads quickly. We'll learn about viruses and how our bodies respond to them. And engineers have developed an automated way to pick a common vegetable. We'll find out how it stacks up against human workers. Anna Groves is an assistant editor at Discover Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, let's start with that robot to harvest produce. I think many of us buy fruits and veggies at the grocery store without thinking too much about how they got there, but a lot of work and a lot of workers make that possible. What was the VeggieBot designed to pick?
Well, VeggieBot was specifically designed for iceberg lettuce.
And that's the really tight, tight kind of head, right?
Right.
And so I guess when you're trying to automate something like picking lettuce, you have to break it down into many more actions than we might think of. What are the challenges in that?
Well, the first challenge is just being able to see where a head of lettuce is in a sea of green leaves. Maybe there's weeds. The next challenge is figuring out which heads are actually mature and ready to pick. There might be immature heads that need to stay in the field for a little longer. There might be infected heads that you don't want to throw in with your good heads because they might contaminate the rest.
And also, I mean, there are several movements probably involved too, right? You have to figure out where the stem is. You have to cut the stem. You have to pick it up. I mean, that's all mm-hmm. kind of probably one fluid movement for a person, but for a robot, it's a very different thing.
Right. It's a lot more complicated than it might seem if you were just doing it with your hands. Normally, a worker will use a knife to slice off the base of the lettuce head, but it's actually a very small margin for error for how long that little stem has to be. So when you picture a head of iceberg lettuce, you don't even really picture a stem, but there is one, and it's just like 2 or 3 millimeters, just about like the length of the white part of your thumbnail. I was just going to say, if it's any less than that, if you cut the stem too short, you'll be cutting off the bottom of the leaves. But if it's too long, grocery stores won't even take it because they really want that teeny tiny stem holding things together.
And so let's not keep our listeners in suspense. How did the veggie bot do compared to human beings?
Well, it did okay. It had some good qualities. It was pretty good at figuring out what was a head of lettuce and what was not. But it only had about a 50% success rate on its attempted picks. Mm. And it was 3 times slower than a human.
So what might that mean? Obviously, that's one model and one type of vegetable. But what might that mean for other attempts to automate produce harvesting?
Well, it just goes to show that this is such a complicated process. I mean, different types of produce are going to need different robots to pick them. Like you wouldn't need the same technology to pick berries or grapes or apples.
Hmm. And actually, some of those seem like it would be significantly trickier than a head of iceberg lettuce.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we won't be holding out hope right now for automating all kinds of harvesting. Let's move on to another topic, viruses. With recent outbreaks of the measles and other communicable diseases, viruses have been in the news a lot lately. Remind us how viruses spread.
So viruses often that affect humans will originate in other animals. Like you've probably heard of things like swine flu and avian flu. Those are named from the pigs and birds that they came from. And how they make the leap to humans is because the genetic information that's in the virus is slowly mutating over time as it replicates. So once a virus gets a mutation that lets it live in human cells instead of wherever it came from, that's when we start to see these new viral outbreaks.
Hmm. And I'm guessing that if viruses can evolve enough to move from one species to another, they can also continue to evolve once they've, for instance, entered the human pool.
That's right. And the most famous example of that is probably just the influenza virus that gives you the common flu, because that's why you have to get a different flu shot every year, is because the strains have evolved so much just from year to year that last year's flu shot is no longer relevant.
So what factors can lead to localized outbreaks like we've seen with the measles in the last year or so where there's a big cluster in one area?
Well, the most recent outbreaks like the measles are really clearly linked to a lack of vaccination. So this is just a new thing that we see popping up more and more as more and more people seem to think it's okay not to vaccinate their children, but really the scientific consensus is that all that gets you is more measles. But just in general, anytime a new virus or a new strain of an existing virus mutates and makes the jump to humans, once that has spread to enough new people, that's when you are really at risk for an outbreak.
We're talking with Anna Groves right now. She's assistant editor at Discover Magazine. We're talking about some of the most recent news from the world of science. And so when we come into contact with a virus, how do our bodies react to protect us?
Well, your body has multiple waves of defense in your immune system. So the first wave that comes to arms, really, is the macrophages. And these are big cells that will engulf any viruses that they come across. But if that doesn't work, that's when T cells and B cells from your immune system will step up. And so these are where you get antibodies, which are little molecules that will hook onto a virus and either mark them for destruction by other cells or sometimes they can make it so that the virus can't actually replicate.
And so what happens differently in a body that has been vaccinated against a specific virus versus one that has not?
So these T and B cells are the same cells that give your immune system a memory of past viruses. So once you've gotten sick with something once, if that virus comes along again, these T and B cells are sort of ready to go, and that makes them way more effective at fighting off the virus. So what a vaccination does is it gives you a little dose of that virus, and it's usually in a form that won't actually make you sick, but it's enough for the T and B cells to quote-unquote remember it when you are exposed to the virus in real time. So it makes them more effective.
And there have been some big successes in the 20th century, the eradication of smallpox, and for most of the world, polio as well. What would we need to do to have more wins like those?
Well, I think the biggest thing is just to keep vaccination numbers up. There's a lot of researchers who study things like herd immunity. That might be a phrase you've heard, mm-hmm. where there's sort of a critical number of people that need to be vaccinated in order to keep the whole population safe. So the more people that we have saying that they don't want to be vaccinated against anything, that's sort of moving in the opposite direction of eradicating these diseases, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the herd is becoming less and less immune, not to call groups of people herds. But
well, actually, speaking of herds, we had a caller, Dennis, from Two Rivers, who wants to know if all of what you were explaining, Anna, means that we should be vaccinating animals more.
That's a really good question, and I think there are a lot of vaccinations that animals will get already. I worry, though, that that doesn't solve the problem of the viruses jumping from animals to humans. I don't know that much about that.
Well, it was a good question, and it was perfect lead-in when you were referring to the herd.
Yeah.
Finally, we'll talk about the microbiome. Scientists are studying the gut biome of the Yanomami people, native people in the Amazonian rainforest. Why is that?
Yeah, so this team of researchers is looking at this microbiome because these people are hunter-gatherers, and they're living in a remote society that has never had any antibiotics or processed foods.
And so what are they hoping to learn from what lives in the digestive system of these people versus you or me?
Yeah, they were really hoping to see what sort of a historical is maybe not the right word, but what a gut microbiome might look like for people that have never been exposed to these Western diets. So what they found was pretty remarkable. They found the gut microbes of the Yanomami were twice as diverse as the average Westerner and had different species that Westerners like us don't even have in our guts.
Well, and I was so interested to read that just like there is the seed vault mm-hmm. to preserve seeds in case of a worldwide catastrophe, they're actually trying to save these microbes in a vault as well.
Yeah. So originally, the work was just a bunch of different researchers who were starting to collect different microbes from different populations. But then they started to think, like, wow, this really needs to be safe somewhere. Like, this is too important. So it hasn't been built yet, but they're working about making a microbiota vault. And they just formed this new trust group in 2018 that they're trying to get this started. But the idea is that it'll be a big vault somewhere cold. So it'll be safe if, like, the freezer breaks. And it will be a stockpile of all of these unique species from different places across the world.
And so how could the rest of the world benefit from the information, but also from saving, from protecting these bacteria?
Well, the hope is that these bacteria could someday, somehow, be available to a wider population of people. So as researchers learn more and more about what these different microbes do, it might lead to treatments of people with unhealthy guts, might be able to get a supplement or maybe a fecal transplant or something like that from these healthier microbes.
Wow, it's really an interesting new development. It seems like not even that long that we've been talking about the microbiome at all, and then to have this kind of development is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, Anna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Anna Groves is an assistant editor at Discover Magazine. She joined us for our monthly check-in on some of the latest science news. Coming up, we'll take a look at the new Trump administration rule that would restrict asylum for most Central American migrants. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. 50 years ago this week, humans stepped foot on the moon for the very first time. Coming up, we'll tell the story of Apollo 11 through some of the artifacts on display at the Smithsonian. First, a new rule from the Trump administration would block most Central Americans from claiming asylum in the United States. This new policy is scheduled to take effect tomorrow. It says that asylum seekers who pass through another country before reaching the U.S.-Mexico border will be ineligible for asylum. Instead, they'd have to make their claim in the country through which they passed. In a statement today, the American Civil Liberties Union vowed to, quote, sue swiftly. Rick Sue is a law professor at the University of North Carolina. He's an expert in immigration, citizenship, and asylum. Rick, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
How big a deal would you say this new policy is?
The policy itself, I would say, is probably one of the most significant moves by the Trump administration to both deter and limit immigration from Central American countries. Whether it will stand, however, I think is another question. But in terms of the numbers affected, this is by far the biggest.
And we're talking specifically about asylum seekers here. Remind us exactly what category that is.
So asylum seekers are humanitarian relief that we grant to individuals who are essentially fleeing for their lives, fear of persecution in their host country. For the most part, this was developed after World War II in response to the Holocaust. But since then, of course, there have been many circumstances in which it has arisen. And I think a lot of the violence in the Central American countries is pushing a lot of individuals right now up to the United States, which is why we're seeing a lot more family units as opposed to economic migrants.
And how difficult is it currently to be granted asylum to live in the U.S.?
Asylum is not easy to get. There is a lot of hoops you have to jump through, a lot of different criteria that must be met. Not only that you have a well-founded fear of persecution, but also on very specific grounds. And also, the asylum applicant carries all the burden of doing so. So in some ways, even being able to apply for asylum doesn't guarantee it. And in fact, most people don't get it. On the other hand, however, we have a process to ensure that everyone has the opportunity to apply, because out of the thousands that apply, there are a few that gets it, and they are in fact in fear of their lives. We don't want to be the one sending them back.
So if I'm reading this correctly, practically speaking, this new rule would basically eliminate asylum for pretty much anyone from Central America, because they would have to pass through Mexico first. That would trigger this, and they would then have to go and apply for it in Mexico or perhaps even another country that they've passed through. Is that a correct reading?
Yeah, that is a correct reading. There are a little bit of exceptions for individuals who are trafficked and other smaller groups, but I would say out about the 160,000 or so asylum claims that were filed last year from individuals coming from the southern border, this law would ban the vast majority of them, if not essentially all of them.
It seems that a fair number of the Central American migrants who would be coming and hoping to apply for and receive asylum, the countries that they might be passing through may not be in any better shape than the country from which they started. Is this realistic for them to even be able to do the application process in one of these other intermediate countries?
Yeah. So this is, I think, the one major issue. And it's not just a practical issue. It's in the law itself. Congress has actually written about safe third country requirements. And one of the things that they have required in the law is that not only should there be an agreement between the United States and those countries, but that they are safe and that there is a fair and full process for processing asylum claims. Though both of those second criteria, actually the first one as well with agreement, is questionable with regard to Mexico and certainly with regard to Guatemala, which is another country that the administration has mentioned that asylum seekers should be applying in before coming to the United States.
Oh, and I believe that President Trump was supposed to be meeting with the Guatemalan president partly to hammer out an agreement relating to this, but it turned out that the Guatemalan president would likely need the approval of their legislature instead of him being able to do it himself. Is that right?
Yeah, and this seems to be connected in part to that negotiation and a separate negotiation that the Trump administration's been working on with Mexico. In fact, one thing that was really interesting about the rule itself is that once you probe deeply into it, one of the motivations or one of the purposes of the rule, as it is stated, is to increase more leverage for these kind of negotiations. So this seems to be in response to maybe the failed and maybe some of the stalled negotiations that are going on, but it also seems to be an effort to, in some ways, push these countries to consider it in more detail. Of course, that doesn't necessarily deal with the issue of whether those countries are in fact safe or have a fair or full process for asylum applications.
We're talking with Rick Hsu right now. He's a law professor at the University of North Carolina. He's an expert in immigration, citizenship, and asylum. And we're talking about a new rule that would go into effect tomorrow that would further limit how and who could apply for asylum in the United States. In a statement, Rick, Attorney General William Barr said that the U.S., while generous, is overwhelmed with arresting and processing hundreds of thousands of migrants at the southern border. What is your understanding of the current conditions there?
Yeah, I do think that I do think Attorney General Barr is correct in this sense. We are overwhelmed. There is a lot of applicants. And in some ways, the facilities and institutions that we set up is not suited to this number of asylum applications. So in that case, that it's absolutely correct. On the other hand, however, asylum was a rule developed in some ways to deal with crises, to deal with surges. It'd be strange to think that we would develop an asylum rule that only deals with one or two individuals applying, as opposed to, let's say, the Holocaust, in which an entire group of population of people are applying. So although I understand that there are a lot of difficulties, it is interesting that in some ways the humanitarian aspect of asylum in some ways foresees that there would be surges and that countries would in some ways have to step up to meet those.
The ACLU has said that the rule is, quote, patently unlawful. What is the argument behind that statement?
Yeah, so it seems to be that the argument that they're going to be raising is probably in relation to what Congress has written in law with regard to safe third country requirements, and probably suggesting that they have to follow the criteria that's set in law as by Congress, which requires agreements, a safe country, and a fair and full process for asylum. On the other hand, however, I believe that the administration will likely argue that there is a lot of other provisions in the law that give discretion to the attorney general, and that's a discretion that he's exercising. So there's going to be a little bit of a balance here with regard to the broad language and then the very specific language on safe third countries and asylum applications in those countries before coming here.
There has been a pretty steady stream of efforts from the Trump administration to crack down on asylum seekers and other types of migrants before. Nearly all of those efforts have been blocked by the courts, at least temporarily. What are some of those measures that the Trump administration attempted to put into place that are potentially on hold indefinitely?
Yeah, so there's been a number of them. The first in the beginning is just to change the substantive qualifications for asylum. And this dealt specifically to essentially barring claims with regard to domestic violence or criminal violence, gang violence within those specific countries. That's on hold right now. The more specific one that's related, I think, in this case is another one that actually specifically said that that asylum applicants have to come in through a port of entry in order to apply for asylum. And the reason why I think that one's interesting is because not only was it held up by a district court and a federal appellate court, but the Supreme Court actually refused to sort of stay the injunction in that particular case. And there's a lot of similarities in how that case is set up with how this case is set up in terms of what the administration is arguing and likely what opponents of that law will be arguing as well with regard to the language in the law.
And very briefly, Rick, before we wrap up, a lot of the language around these efforts has been deterrence. Is there any evidence that these are deterring people from coming north?
Yeah. So right now, the evidence is scarce. And we've certainly done a lot. Family separation, changing the substantive requirements. The numbers are flagging right now, but in some ways, that's probably related to the weather. And we certainly saw a spike before, and that was after the family separation policy. I believe the reason why this particular policy was set to go into effect tomorrow was probably in light of the fact that in order to be deterrence, there can't be too much warning. But on the other hand, I can see a lot of people seeing the writing on the wall and maybe surging on the border right now. So it's hard. Deterrence is a very hard thing to manage.
And we'll have to leave it there. Rick Sue is a law professor at the University of North Carolina. He joined us to talk about a Trump administration rule that says if migrants pass through another country and don't apply for protection there, they cannot seek asylum in the U.S. That is set to take effect tomorrow. Earlier in the show, we talked about a few different scientific studies and what we can learn from them. Well, a Canadian researcher named Nora Keegan is sharing what she learned from studying the effect hand dryers in public restrooms can have on children's ears. She noticed that even if adults didn't seem bothered by it, kids would often shy away from them and cover their ears. This made sense to her because when Nora started her research, she was 9 years old. During a two-year period, she used a professional decibel meter to measure how loud the dryers were in 40 public restrooms around the province of Alberta. And she took into consideration that kids' ears are a lot closer to the dryers than adults are. Now, 13 years old, Nora presented her findings at a Calgary Youth Science Fair earlier this year. She found that a few models, including two made by Dyson, had decibel levels higher than are allowed for children's toys in Canada because of the risk to their hearing. Dyson told NPR that they are sending an acoustic engineer to meet with Nora about her findings. They may have to wait a little bit, though, because even though she is now a recognized scientist, she's just enjoying being a kid at summer camp. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then, what do rocks, a parachute, and a contraption to collect urine have in common? Well, they all played key roles in the Apollo space program. We'll talk about those and other objects you can see to mark 50 years since we landed on the moon. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.